Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is January 24th, 2022, and my guest is John Taylor, the Marion Robert Riemann Professor of Economics at Stanford University and the George P. Schultz Senior Fellow in Economics at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. This is John's sixth appearance on the program. He was last here in April of 2012, which seems like a different century, talking about rules, discretion, and first principles. Our topic for today is inflation. I want to remind listeners that voting was close soon for your favorite episodes of 2021, so please go to econtalk.org where you'll find a link to the survey that will let you pick your favorite episodes of last year. John, welcome back to Econ Talk.
Good to be here. Thanks, Russ. Thanks for having me.
Well, for the first time in a long time, there's inflation in America and elsewhere, and people are unnerved by this, and many listeners have written to me asking for some kind of primer or the basics of inflation. That's our goal today. I want to start with and I'm sure we'll get into some more complicated things along the way, but I want to start with just the simplest idea, which is actually quite complex, and people typically, I think, have trouble with it, which is, what is inflation? When we say inflation is 3%, or we say inflation's a problem, or we say inflation is rising, what does that mean?
That's a good question. It's a good place to begin. First of all, you have to think about a measure of prices. What economists do and statisticians do is they measure the average level of prices. Sometimes it's the average level of consumer prices. That gives you something called the consumer price index. Kind of it's an average. And the average gives higher weight to items which people purchase more of and less weight for people who purchase less. So it's a comprehensive index, consumer price index. Inflation is how much that changes over time. How much does it change month per month, year to year, over a long period of time? And it is meant to be comprehensive, as you mentioned. And again, the consumer price index is consumer prices in the U.S. The producer price index is producer prices. So that's what we're referring to. And the concern that many people have paid attention to and mentioned recently is that these average prices are rising quite a bit. And so just for example, the consumer price index, if you measured over the last year from December 20 to December 21, it's around 7%. So that's quite a large increase. And it includes all sorts of stuff, gasoline, meat, food, rents, everything. It's not everything is going up, but a lot is going up.
And I think it's important to distinguish between a price, a single price going up. That's not inflation. Doesn't mean that there is inflation. It doesn't cause inflation. So if you notice that for whatever reason, let's say there's a refinery issue in America and gasoline prices are rising, that doesn't mean there's inflation. It means one of the prices of the many, many things we buy has gone up, and it's very possible that other things have gone down. In fact, they could have gone down more so that there's actually deflation, even though some prices might be rising. But the key part of what you've just described is that there's a basket of stuff that the government measures the average price of that basket, and they try to base that basket on what people spend money on. And that basket's not the same for you as it is for me. It's not the same if you live in Palo Alto, California versus Biloxi, Mississippi. So it is a crude measure of the overall impulse in prices to be rising over a period of time. And what was it? When was it last close to 7%? Pretty high relative to recently.
It's very high. It's been much lower than that. It has not been a concern. Of course, if you go way back in time, it was even higher. In the 70s, it was quite high. And there's each time it was high, there's evidence that at a broader basis, monetary policy was too aggressive in the sense of letting inflation rise. So we can get back to that, Russ. But I think if you look in the 70s in the United States, inflation got over 7%, got up to double digits. And what had to happen was the Fed had to undo that. And it was very painful. So what we hope is the undoing is not so painful. But ultimately, we haven't gone into this, but ultimately the broader based movements that you're referring to are really very closely related to monetary policy. Yes, you can have an increase in one item, two items, and decreases in others. In fact, in the Fed and other central banks, they think of the best rate is 2. The 2 is the target. If we had 2% inflation, it would be fine. In fact, for a long time, we had 2. That was good. And you mentioned that inflation rose in the past, but frequently it's just one price or that price. But this is different now, at least in the U.S., it's different. It's not just one price. Again, it's across the board. We haven't seen the consumer price index, which is just that average you're referring to. So it takes into account some prices are declining for sure. But on average, the inflation rate is close to 7%. And that's a concern because we don't want to have it that high forever. And we can talk a little bit about the costs of inflation and maybe it's not as costly as people think, but the Fed and others have a 2% target.
Well, you raise an interesting. We're going to talk about the role of monetary policy. A standard explanation of inflation is it's caused by too many dollars chasing too few goods. Is the way it's often described. That's not a bad starting point, at least the way I was educated. But we'll come back to that when we talk about the cause. But I first want to talk about whether it's something we should worry about. Why is it a concern? Yes, the Fed has a target of 2%, but let's say it's just 7% year in, year out. Is that a bad thing? What's wrong with that?
Well, first of all, it's bad if it's not across the board. And frequently, we just talked about prices. And so if prices are rising that much and wages are not rising, then it's really cutting into people's income quite a bit. So I think what you're asking is, what's so bad about a system which is 7% and everybody, wages are increasing, prices are increasing? And I think there's probably the number one problem with that is it really erodes the ability of monetary policy to work. It doesn't really work anymore. And so that's taking away a big part of stabilization in the economy. Fortunately, Russ, we've given up on that.
Can you explain? Let's back up for a sec. Sure. Let's say inflation 7% and it's year in, year out, and it's pretty steady. And I would have thought, if you'd asked me why is it dangerous, I would say, well, because it might be 12 next year. And if people don't prepare for that, their wages are going to not keep up and it's going to bite into their standard of living. And people can't plan for what the cost of things are going to be in the future. And it hurts businesses' effectiveness. But let's just talk about the 7%. Let's say it's 7% year in, year out. It's not rising. The rate itself, the rate of inflation. Prices are rising, but at a constant rate, the rate itself isn't rising. It's stuck at 7%. And now there's a recession, right? There's a recession, and normally the Fed might respond to that. Talk about how and why, if inflation is 7%, it limits its ability to do so. And then you can talk about, we don't believe it anymore, whatever else you were going to add.
Well, the thing is, if you have a 7% inflation, then interest rates will have to be 9%, 10%, because they need to be a little higher than the inflation rate to have their effect. And so a world where interest rates are average 7 or 8% is a different world. We had that world in the past, and it wasn't pleasant, frequently because interest rates went up and interest rates went down. And so it caused a real problem with the allocation of resources. The interest rate is a very important variable in the economy. It affects how much people invest, how much people save. And I think you're pointing to a very important issue. If the inflation rate is rising and falling, and frequently it's not just 7. In fact, I'm looking at a history of inflation in the United States. It was never just 7. It was 7, and it got higher and higher, and then it got lower and lower. So I think what's good about the 2, and maybe it should be 1.5, we don't know for sure. What's good about the 2 is that it's reasonably close to 0. It's actually pretty much global. Many other countries think it's a good target at this point. And from an international perspective, it's also good to have a similar inflation rate in different countries, because that way the exchange rate is not always changing. If you have a very high inflation rate and the rest of the world has low, then your currency is going to be depreciating. Yes, if it's a steady rate, who cares, you could put it, but it's not a steady rate. This is not rocket science. This is something which it's difficult to pursue, and the 2% is a good target to have. If you go to 7, almost for sure, central banks will want to reduce it back to some lower level, and that's what they'll do, and you can be sure that's what the Fed is thinking about now.
But I think, again, there's a question of why they would want to do that, and I think there's always, I think in the back of monetary theorists like yourself and people who advise and encourage the Fed to do certain things, there's a risk of hyperinflation at a time. And again, it's not so much the hyperinflation means a higher rate than, say, 7, a much higher rate can be 100%. Prices could double every year. And again, I think the issue isn't so much whether they're doubling, it's whether they're doubling some years and tripling in others and going up 50% in others. And what that starts to do is discourage the use of the economic system for exchanging goods. It encourages people to barter because goods keep their value and money doesn't. So, if you swap a chicken for $10 and in a few months or a few weeks or in some systems a few days, the $10 doesn't buy a whole chicken anymore, you have an incentive to get rid of your money. And after a while, you just start to insist on people giving you chickens. And then you're in a barter economy, and all of a sudden, you're a lot poorer. And this is the world that has happened numerous times in world history, and it is devastating to well-being, financial material well-being, and devastating really to civilization. People start spending a huge amount of time trying to find people to swap stuff with because they don't have the power of currency to exchange. They have to use goods, and they have to find people who want the things they have, chickens if you're a chicken farmer, or haircuts if you're a barber. And that's just incredibly inefficient. So although I make fun of efficiency occasionally on this program as an economic goal, if you start to destroy the use of currency as a way for people to exchange goods, you get a lot poorer.
No, that's for sure. Actually, this is not a new idea either, Russ. It's very important to point out. If you can see behind me, there's a California license plate. I don't know if you can see it.
I can see it, yeah.
Okay, those are actually
for
Milton.
For those watching on YouTube, yeah.
If you're watching, yes. Those are Milton Friedman's license plates. He was out here for a while. And the M is money, V is velocity. Well,
explain what's on the license plate.
The money, it says MV equals PY. That's money times velocity equals the price level times GDP. And so the equal sign is not the official signal of California. It's a piece of tape that Milton Friedman put onto the plate. And occasionally, I understood from Milton, is that the California Highway Patrol would take the equal sign down, but Milton would put it up the next day. So it would still say money times velocity equals price times income. And it's an old thing. You know, it's called the quantity equation of money. It said if you increase M, you can see it right there, if you increase money a lot and velocity doesn't change, and output doesn't change, and we're not going to make output change, unfortunately. Only thing that happens is inflation rises. And your questions are, what is so bad about inflation rising? And one thing that's bad is people don't like it. People say, hey, this is a terrible situation. It wasn't like, and back when we look in other countries, Zimbabwe, or look at the United States in the 70s, people didn't like it. And so they threw the guys out, and there was all sorts of complaints. The chairman of the Fed in the 70s was Arthur Burns. He said, it wasn't me. Don't look at me. It's something else. And so he told Nixon, who was the president of the United States at the time, to just have controls. Just have controls on wages and prices. And that's what Nixon did. Didn't work. And so Burns eventually left and was replaced, and things got better. Sorry to go on and on so much.
Oh, no, that's your job. I want to say something about MV equals PY. So Y, you said GDP, and then another time you said income, another time you said output. They're all approximately the same thing. In economics, I tends to stand for the interest rate, the letter I. So they needed, economists need a different letter for income because it starts with an I, so they used Y. So that's why it's MV equals PY. And I think it goes back, correct me if I'm wrong, to Irving Fisher and his book, The Theory of Interest, which might also include, if not that work, other works of Irving's that have hydraulic systems to try to visualize a visual representation of the way that money percolates through the economy. And you know, the idea, as you said, is that if V, the velocity at which money is moving through the economy, and Y, don't the output level, which is hard to change in the short run, increases in M, just result in higher prices, higher levels of the price level, which if you continue to do that, leads to inflation, sustained, ongoing increases in the average level of prices in the economy. Let's talk about causation and what causes inflation. There used to be a big debate in the profession of economics about what did cause inflation. Most of that seems to have been forgotten. We're starting over to some extent. When I was in graduate school, inflation, to quote Milton Friedman, was everywhere and always a monetary phenomenon. There were other theories of inflation, such as, you could argue, corporate greed, which many people are doing on Twitter these days or elsewhere on the floor of the Senate, that because corporations want to make more money, they're raising prices. Of course, the problem with that theory is they always want to make more money. Why are they able to raise prices now and not other times? Did they just get greedy today and not yesterday? So there are other theories, including issues about the supply side and the demand side. But you believe, I believe, that it's money. What do you think of those other theories? Anything to them?
Not much. They've been around for a long time. As you pointed out, they've come back into popularity now. But it's in a sense a replay. It used to be in the 70s. Oh, it's just supply side. Just have to have controls, like Burns, who was the chairman of the Fed, said at the time. And now there's the supply constraints they're putting to the ships waiting to come into the harbor, yeah, for example.
Is that relevant?
Oh, that's no, it's not really relevant, because on top of this, you have this extraordinary, unusual monetary policy. Interest rates are very, very low compared to what they would normally be. And we have other ways to measure this. We can get into it if you like. But I think the idea that it's not money is a small minority. And there's always hope. There's always hope out there that it's something else. And economics is tough. You teach it, you talk about it. It's easy to make up new stories. And sure, hey, it must be these supply constraints that's doing it. But when you look at the difference, if you look at money growth, if you look at the interest rates, if you look at what the Fed is doing, it is very unusual. We've never seen it this bad before. You're referring to periods. In fact, it's even worse than the 70s. And we don't know if it'll continue. There's lots of talk at the Fed about making some adjustments. But right now, it's way off. And I think you can look at other theories, but what dominates this discussion is monetary policy. And through history, you can see, and why did inflation pick up in the 70s? It wasn't just for supply. People say, it's OPEC or something like that. No, and as soon as the Fed changed, and Paul Volcker was the person, it changed and inflation came down again. And then the Fed had targets, and it has been very low until very recently.
Well, let me say something about the 70s, and then I want to come back to the supply constraints, the so-called global supply chain problems we've been having in the COVID era. You know, in the 70s, in the aftermath of the OPEC, the oil embargo, which 1973 approximately, you know, people said, oh, that's obviously the cause of the very high inflation in the second part of the 70s. The problem with that theory is that the OPEC theory explains why the price of oil is high. It doesn't explain why the price of everything is high. And they'd say, well, but oil's used in other things. That's true, but it's a lot of things it's not used in at all. And those things, if we understand that the things that use a lot of oil and very energy intensive would get more expensive in those time periods. But if monetary policy was not expansionary, those other things could have gotten less expensive, and they didn't. And it's easy to get confused by relative price changes. But what we're talking about when we talk about inflation is the overall rise across the whole economy. So let's turn to the supply chain argument. I'm going to digress for a minute, maybe, because I know you teach principles of economics and have for a long time. To me, the most startling and challenging and jarring aspect of the COVID almost 2 years now is that prices didn't rise at the retail level. We have all these shortages. We have things that would never have ever happened in the United States in my lifetime. That is empty shelves. Yes, we had empty gasoline pumps when we had price controls on gasoline in the 70s. But the idea of going into a store and not being able to find meat, not being able to find toilet paper, is what we think of as is what happens under communism. For that to happen under capitalism requires there to be something that is restraining prices from rising. And it could be law, sometimes legislation. It could be there's anti-price gouging rules that keep them from happening. Or it could be cultural. The businesses are uneasy raising prices during this kind of cultural challenge. But how do you think about that? Do you talk about that in your class? How do you, as somebody who's, I used to teach all the time how prices cause markets to clear, and we don't have shortages in the United States unless there's legislation against prices rising. And yet what we've had until the last few months and the last year is lots of shortages, prices not rising, and no inflation. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the system, you know, was a terrible hit, that's for sure. But the system was working pretty well. Some prices were some shelves were empty, so orders were up, ships were lined up, couldn't get the stuff in. But I think there are always constraints like that. There are always issues on the supply side. What is very different now is monetary policy. And you can point to that. It began a year ago, a year and a half ago. I think the action that the Federal Reserve and other central banks took in March, April, May of 2020 was quite reasonable. But then this continued all through in 2021. And inflation started to pick up. And, you know, I have, there's other industries besides M equals PY that you can see that. And people were pointing out, but the Fed, I think, was concerned about the kind of things you're mentioning, and others were too. They don't have the history. They look at it as much as I do or you do or the students taking Economics 1 do. And so it has to be emphasized. But it seems to me you always have the supply side. The point is, you could have a slow growth economy. You could have a fast growth economy. And that is largely due to other things besides monetary policy. It's tax policy, it's regulatory policy, it's the capitalist system versus democracy, it's the state of activity that the economy is in at that point in time. So your monetary policy has to be attuned to that. And right now, we think that the growth rate is around maybe 2.5%. I don't know.
The economy as a whole?
Yes, 2.5 real growth for the economy. Well, so we'll see. It might be higher, might be lower, but there's not much debate about that. The issue is inflation, and there's, again, more and more people are coming around to the idea. Other people like me have been arguing for a while. They're coming around to the idea that this has to be taken care of, and the Fed is the place to do it. There's going to be debate for sure, Russ, just as you indicated.
But here's the puzzle for me. Well, I don't pay as much attention to the Fed quite as much as John Taylor does. I think that's there are many people who don't. John is in a very small club that pays an immense amount of attention to the Fed, which is good because you hold their feet to the fire occasionally and sometimes often. But what did they do that was so different a year or so ago that was concerning to people who worry about inflation? What was the change in their policy that was so dramatic?
They first of all, they held interest rates near zero when all the indicators of inflation was picking up, the economy was returning close to normal, not exactly. So all the things you'd normally have a higher interest rate were signaling raise the rate. And the Fed didn't do that. There's various reasons for that. It's not just the Fed. The European Central Bank had a slightly negative rate. They haven't made the adjustments yet. They're debating that at the Bank of Japan. So it's an international phenomenon, and we can talk about this, but central banks do react to each other and think about what's happening. But ultimately, at this point, the Fed kept rates and still the interest rates near zero. They haven't made the adjustments yet.
But when you say interest rates, let's back up for a minute. We probably talked about this on the program before, but since I don't remember it, I'm sure many listeners don't either. There are different kinds of interest rates. There's the interest people, I think about the interest rates in their daily life that they might have. You might have a mortgage that has an interest rate on it. You might have a bond that promises you a certain rate of return for you lending that money to a company or to a government. But the Fed has particular interest rates that it adjusts that then affect other interest rates and the rest of the economy. So talk about when you say the Fed kept interest rates low, I assume you're talking about the rates that they directly control, not the ones they try to indirectly control. And if so, explain.
Well, for the most part, the rate which the Fed has normally controlled, in the sense of they're adjusting the supply of money to bring that rate into line, has been the federal funds rate. It's the overnight rate that banks charge when they lend to each other. But since the Fed can control the amount of liquidity, the amount of money in the economy, they can affect that rate. So that's the primary rate that's near zero. When I say the rate is near zero, I mean the short-term rate. You can look it up, federal funds rate. Look it up on any website, and you'll see it's like 0.1 or 0.15. That's the rate I'm referring to. And that rate does feed back into mortgage rates, longer-term rates, the rates you have to pay on for borrowing a car, the rates businesses have to pay. And so if that rate is very low, that increases the amount of demand in the economy. And that's what you're seeing now, even though the supply has not increased very much. In fact, you could argue the supply is declining. So the Federal Reserve, and I think more people should know about the Fed. It's a very important entity. It's got a great deal of independence in the United States, and it's a very important phenomenon. We have monetary policy. We also have fiscal policy. That's the deficit. We're not talking about that so much. We're talking about monetary policy. And for the most part, that's what the Fed does. And they do other things. They buy bonds. They sell bonds, sometimes called quantitative easing, because they've increased the size of their so-called balance sheet quite a bit. It's another measure of policy. They've agreed to stop increasing it, but it's going to be very large in a couple months or so. So there's other measures. But the thing that I'm focused on mainly now, and central banks do for the most part, is this shorter-term interest rate. And that's the number that is near zero in the U.S. And if the Fed began to raise that, as they have in the past, there again, this is the most unusual discrepancy, the most unusual divergence between what the interest rate is, the federal funds rate, the overnight rate that banks charge each other. That rate is as low as it's ever been compared to what is the best determinants of that, which is inflation very high, and that has to be taken care of.
So you're arguing, make sure I understand, you're arguing that the Federal Reserve has kept that overnight rate low. Now, do they keep that low statutorily? Do they literally set that rate, or do they intervene in the market to cause the rate to be at a particular level?
For the most part, they intervene in the market to cause that rate to be that. They have, they buy and sell bonds, and they provide the amount of so-called liquidity, is what economists call it, to make the rate low. So they would supply less to make the rate higher. And there's questions about how to do that, how fast to do that. They've been reluctant to do that, obviously. But they're as far off as I've ever seen.
But hasn't that been true now for a long, long time? I mean, I think there's always a temptation to, the 7% is a big number. And you mentioned before we started recording that the producer price index rose 20% last year, which is suggestive of future consumer price increases that will exceed 7%. But hasn't the Fed been off the rails for 15 years? And haven't interest rates been near zero? When I say interest rates, not necessarily the federal funds rate, but overall interest rates for low risk activity in the economy. Hasn't this been a much bigger, longer, older problem
Well, it has been a longer. I mentioned the 70s is a problem, but there's a period in 2004, 5, 6 where the rate was also low compared to inflation, compared to the state of the economy. And that ultimately meant the Fed had to react. And so they reacted, and we had this terrible recession, 2007 and 8. And so that's some of the dangers of providing too much. It has to be offset. And so that was offset, and we had a terrible recession. It wasn't good. And then, you as you mentioned, more recent periods, it took a while for the Fed to start raising rates, but they did. Started with Janet Yellen, she was the chair, and then continued with Jay Powell. And then it sort of, they gave up on it, but it still wasn't even close to the difference that we see now. The interest rate was a little low, but the economy wasn't doing that well. There was all sorts of questions about how strong it was going to be in 2014, 2015. But they did start to raise rates in 2016, 17, into 18. And it was only towards the end of 2019 they started to raise them. And then now it's now zero again. So they go up and down, but there are two periods, three if you count the current one, where they are way off. One is the 70s, two is 2004 and 5, and three is now.
Are you suggesting we're going to have a recession soon in the United States?
Not if the Fed does what they need to do. And there's always recessions that are possible, but I'm not predicting a recession. I'm predicting that what the Fed needs to do is make an adjustment. There's nothing wrong with interest rates that are 2%, 3% rather than zero. I'm talking about the federal funds rate, to be sure.
How high did they get during Janet Yellen's time?
Well, Janet just began to raise rates, so probably was still low, but Jay Powell took over and he took them up to, 2.5%, 3%, 2.5%.
And now it's down to 0.1?
Yes.
That's zero, basically. What is the real impact of that? That means that banks can borrow money overnight at a very low cost, right? Because they can.
It feeds into all interest rates. Because the mortgage rates are low, housing prices are increasing. It means there's really too much stimulus in the economy. And again, we have measures of this. It's not like it's never occurred before. It occurred in the 70s. It occurred to the 2003, 4, and 5. And the other periods are pretty close. The other periods there have a higher interest rate. And some of the best periods in the U.S. were the late 80s and 90s. And those were the interest rate was very close to what you'd think it should be given the inflation rate, given the stance of the overall economy. So I think what's different now is they're low. And the Fed knows this. They publish in their reports a set of tables which has rules or procedures for setting the interest rate. One of them is the so-called Taylor rule. And so you can look
Who's that named after?
I don't know.
I think it's John Taylor, but go ahead.
It could be, yes. So they have strategies, and they're off, but some are arguing they should be back. There's some dispute at the Fed about that.
Somebody named Taylor probably arguing that. For those listeners who don't know, John Taylor's research was encapsulated, I would say, in the idea of what has come to be called the Taylor Rule, which is a relationship between the growth rate in the economy, the overall inflation rate and interest rates, and you'll correct me when I'm done with this little summary, but it also has implications. So it's a descriptive statement about that there's a relationship between these things and that when they get out of whack, and you've alluded to that implicitly when you said things like it was way off, if there's a great divergence between the rate that the Fed sets and the rate that seems to go with the current level of growth and inflation, things ripple through the rest of the economy that are not so healthy. Is that a somewhat accurate summary?
Yeah, I think this so-called Taylor Rule, which is so many references, and it's now referred to a lot again, it's a very simple thing. It just say that it's a guide for the interest rate to be set. It's a guide, and it says the interest rate should be higher if inflation's higher. So the fact that inflation is 4, 5, 6% says it should be higher. If the economy is doing poorly, it should be lower. If the economy is doing better, it should be higher. And it's not just higher or lower, it's higher and lower by how much. So you have magnitude so you can compare over time. And it assumes that the target inflation rate is 2, which is what the Fed has said for a long time. Is a debate about what the normal interest rate should be. It could be 1, it could be 2, but no matter what you have, you know, the inflation rate is 4, or say it's 5, say it's 4, so it gives some leeway. And if the economy is still below normal, you want to take a little bit off that, maybe take 1 percentage off. But inflation is better than 2, it's bigger than 2, so add to that. And when you add this up, you get a number like 5. I'll just say it, 4 minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 is 5%.
5, you're saying, should be the federal funds rate.
That's if you just you assume inflation is 4. It'd be, if you assume inflation is 2, the target, then it should be 3. Then the interest rate should be 3. This is a very simple formula. It's simple than MV equals PY. It just has the interest rate and the state of the economy. It's very simple, and that's why central banks refer to it so much.
So the discrepancy between what, let's say, the Taylor rule would suggest, which might be 4 or 5, something between 3 and 5.
Yeah.
Obviously, inflation isn't 4 exactly. It's might be 7 right now. It might be higher, lower. We don't know. But there's, you're saying that the way I would summarize it is that the economy is, quote, overheating, and we need to slow it down a little bit. And one way to do that would be to raise that federal funds rate, which would bring inflation back down. It would reduce the amount of dollars bubbling around and therefore bring the prices down lower. What is the risk of having interest rates that the Fed sets too low at a time when implicitly in the past the relationship has been, it should have been higher, 4 or 5%, say, and now it's close to 0? What's wrong with that? What's going to happen? What do you think is going to happen in the next 6 months to a year?
Well, one terrible thing that could happen is like in the 70s, where we had inflation kept higher and higher, and eventually the Fed said this is enough, and they did it, and we had a terrible recession. Or maybe it was done in the not the most smooth way. There was a debate. I think the other time, which is maybe somewhat more debatable, is the 2004-05-06 period, where the rate was low. And there's always reasons for this. There's always reasons why. It's not just coming from nowhere. So it happens. And the concern is that will happen this time. I do believe that a smooth adjustment, which is well explained and telegraphed, that's one of the advantages of having a rule or a strategy. So people, hey, I can see what's going on. I can see MV equals PY, like in my license plates there. But they can also see this other simple formula, which is directed at the interest rate, starting with the shorter rate, but other rates, which everybody can see, everybody can feel, everybody talks about all the time. They don't talk about MV equals PY. They talk about the interest rate.
So the risk would be that if inflation started getting increasingly higher, again, not just high at 7% relative to, say, over the last few years, but 7 and rising, that the Fed would be encouraged at some point to respond dramatically. It would have a sharp increase in the federal funds rate, which would lead to a sharp contraction of activity by banks, which would lead to a sharp contraction of economic activity, which would lead to a recession. So you're suggesting if they would start to raise it gradually now, they should have done it before, but it's not too late. They could start raising it gradually now and have a, quote, softer landing to a lower rate of inflation in the future rather than trying to bring it down dramatically in a short period of time. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. There's no reason why they have to go all the way instantly. These things take time and the intention. They talk about where they're going. That's why they publish these rules in the reports. They have something called forward guidance. They say what the average estimate will be of the interest rate. For example, the average interest rate at the end of this year is 0.9. So they do have some interest rates. Last year, just last September, they thought it was 0.3. So they've risen from 0.3 to 0.9 at the end of this year. So that's going in the right direction. But again, 0.9 is relatively low compared to 3, which is really where they should be.
What is 0.9?
That's the federal funds rate. 0.9 is what the interest rate will be according to what the Fed says, the average member of the FOMC at the end of 2020.
So it's actually point one, but it they intend it, they, some measure of expectations that it will head to 0.9.
Yeah.
So here, the part that's hard, I think, for me and for, I think, for certainly for the non-economists is the following. You're saying that the Fed is allowing inflation to rise and they have an opportunity to bring it down with their interest rate policy. They're ignoring that. They're taking a risk. Either it could be a lot of reasons for it. We don't need to go into that right now. But they're taking a risk, and the risk is that inflation will rise even higher, and the reckoning will be even sharper. That's what you're suggesting. Now, that's a statement about Fed policy, what it should be, and you're suggesting they're making a mistake right now. But does that explain why we have high inflation now? Right. In other words, I understand that if we have high inflation, if we were being agnostic about the cause, it would be potentially there's a way to bring it down with an increase in the federal funds rate. Are you suggesting, but you're also suggesting, I think, that 7% is caused by keeping that rate too low for too long. Is that correct?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. This didn't just pop up. These are numbers that have been there really in the last years, if you say you want to think. And so the risk is already there. The 6%, whatever the interest inflation rate is, 4%, 7%, the risk is already there. And the question is, what's the best way to remove that risk? And the best way to remove that risk is to raise the rate, not in a damaging way. It doesn't have to be damaging. If it's announced, if it's clear, if it's the reason they're doing it is clear, and it can be very beneficial. I think it will be more beneficial to the economy. I mean, running at a zero interest rate, what's the advantage of that in the first place? So if you have a sort of normal interest rate, 2% or 3% or something like that, then the economy will function better overall. And I think we'll have a more successful recovery. It doesn't have to be draconian. People are worried it will be because in the past it has, but it doesn't have to be. And I think that as the Fed begins to make these adjustments, we'll have a better recovery than we might otherwise have.
So I mentioned a while ago in our conversation, maybe 10 minutes ago, that you know, individuals have their own experience of interest rates, either that might be in their mortgage. Many of us look at our credit card. Our credit card charges us an interest rate to carry our balance over from month to month. And it also rewards us if we sometimes with our purchases as a form of saving, that we have bank accounts where we store our money that have interest rates. That's what I really always wanted to get to. Hasn't that number been close to zero for forever? I mean, my children who grew up in this low interest rate world, and I would add, by the way, that for the last 50 years, it feels like, you'll correct me, but interest rates, nominal interest rates, that is, the posted interest rates that are available to consumers and savings accounts and money market accounts, they've been trending downward. And is that explained by inflation? Why didn't we have – well, my first question is, has the rates been at zero forever? Meaning
not
the last
forever.
Few years? Last
not
few
forever.
Years.
As I mentioned, they started to increase in 2017, 18, 19. But let me say, there is a debate, for sure, about whether the normal rate should be as low as 4, or maybe it should be 3.
Normal rate of what?
Of the interest rate, the normal interest rate. The normal
set by the Fed.
The average interest rate, yeah. There is debate about that, and John Williams has been one of he's the president of the New York Fed now, has been part of that. But even if you take all that into account, the rate, the interest rate is still too low. In other words, that when I said it should be 5 or 3, that's already taking into account that the normal rate is 1 rather than 2, because in the so-called Taylor rule, it was always meant to be 2. That's it. But there's been research of the Fed that argues it should be 1 or 1/2.
When you say it, which should be 1 or 2?
The longer term interest rate.
Okay. Oh, so not the... Well, explain that.
Yeah, so you normally think of the interest rate in a steady state, in the long run, on average, as equal to the inflation rate plus the real rate. Inflation rate plus the real rate.
So the real rate is the nominal rate, as it's called.
The nominal rate is the inflation rate plus the real rate. There's no debate about inflation that's serious, but there is debate at what the normal long-run rate should be. And in the so-called Taylor rule, it's 30 years old, by the way, was 2. But there's been debate in the last maybe 5 years, it should be 1. So 2 rather than 1. That means the my example before was 5. It should be 5 rather than 6. So 6 to 5, yes. That's because of the rate being lower in the long run. But it's still 5. It's not 0, it's 5. So just to point out the debate about what the interest rate should be in a steady state in the long run, after we're all done the adjustments, is a very minor part of the issue about whether the rate should be now. It's sort of a long run versus a short run. And the short run are way off. And these terms I know are confusing. Economists use it in all different ways. Equilibrium, the technical word sometimes is called R star. That doesn't help anything. But actually, you could go to the Fed's report if any of your readers would do that. The most recent one has the rules right there. You can see it. It's not rocket science. You look at it. Everyone knows it's easier than high school algebra. It's sixth grade algebra, maybe fourth grade. So it's easy.
But I want to try to get at the intuition behind what we're getting at when we say it's way off or it's too high or too, in this case, way too low. It's saying that the Fed, through its overnight federal funds rate, which is a short-term interest rate, is going to ultimately stimulate the economy dramatically in a time when it is already being maybe a little overstimulated in some sense. And therefore, we want monetary policy to be a little bit contractionary when instead it's actually quite expansionary. And that is likely to lead to higher rates of inflation in the future. Is that right?
Yeah, the only correction I would say, I'm not arguing it should be contractionary. It should be normal.
Less expansionary, maybe.
Yeah. Less too much stimulus. Just normal. It should be what worked in the past very well. So to go back, we used to have this term, the great moderation, which referred to a good monetary policy in the late 80s and 90s into just the early part of the century. And that's the kind of policy that we need to get back to. And by the way, during that period, the so-called Taylor rule was right on. I wasn't complaining, didn't write much about it, but it really worked. And periods where it's gotten off is the problem. It's not rocket science, but it's remarkably close.
So there are a lot of people who have their own theories of inflation and monetary policy. Most of them aren't at Stanford University, as you are. And so you're kind of a serious, I would say it differently, everyone has to pay attention to you and take you seriously. Like you said, it's in the report.
You don't have to.
But why don't they? My question is, this is not a secret. It's not like, oh, John Taylor's some crank about this relationship between the interest rate and the growth rate, the long-term rate and the short-term rate. He's a pretty serious guy who's on a short list for a Nobel Prize and should get one, just want to add. But why aren't they doing it? Why aren't they? Don't they know? They know. They know they're way off. What are they thinking? Do they disagree with you? Are they trying to achieve a different end? They're willing to tolerate some inflation to get something else in return? What do you think's going on?
Well, first of all, we have a very serious pandemic, and it hurt the economy, no question about it. And they reacted. I've never complained about the reaction, taking the rate down to 0. The complaint and the dispute is really where they are now. And I think it's a complicated institution. They've used rules or strategies more and less over time. And there could be, we're worried about this terrible plague hitting the economy again. It could be that kind of argument. It could be that there's other things to worry about. It could be politics. It could be all sorts of things. And so the main thing, I'd say one of the advantages of having a rule or a strategy that the central bank, and by the way, it's not just the Fed, it's central banks all over the world. It's really the same formula, it's a little bit of adjustment. Then we would have agreement on what works and what doesn't. we wouldn't have Zimbabwe's. We wouldn't have Venezuela's, for sure. We'd have a better policy. So that's the idea.
Worries of hyperinflation.
Yes, we wouldn't have situations like that. And I think there's hopefully more will come to it. But again, it's not the first time. There's other things that central bankers looked at. I think the current chair spoke very favorably about this approach early on, and now I think he's had to worry about other things. But maybe he'll come back to this. We'll see.
You mentioned fiscal policy in passing. Going back to certainly the early days of of the Trump administration. Let's go back to Obama. We've been running very, very, very large deficits, fiscal deficits, meaning the government spends more than it takes in taxes, and it usually closes that gap by borrowing. But it also can close that gap by essentially printing money. Is that what's going on? I mean, doesn't monetary and fiscal policy merge to some extent? And have they in the last 15 years or so, as the United States has relentlessly, very often spent beyond its means? There's always an excuse. There's always an argument. And to be honest, I've been surprised at how well the economy has absorbed those very, very large deficits. I know it's something you're worried about. Should we be worried about them? Do they have implications for monetary policy? Do they have implications for inflation? Are they relevant at all?
Well, they don't have implications for monetary policy if the central bank follows kind of strategy or rule that I indicated, because it's not the deficit's not there. But you asked about what could cause deviations from that. Maybe fiscal policy is one of them. We had $1 trillion deficits with President Trump at the end, and they continued. So I think that's a bit of a problem for the economy itself. It'd be better if we had a lower deficit. I think the same is true right now. What good do these deficits do? A whole other part of my writing is to examine the stimulus packages. And there's been three, counting one with President Biden, two with President Trump. And as far as I can say, they didn't really help at all. The people were saving, and you can see it in the data very clear. So that's a whole other thing of fiscal policy. It'd be better if we had a fiscal policy that was more in line, more pro-growth, if you like. And at this point, I think that means moving towards a smaller deficit. And there's big debates about that, as you know, in the United States. But I wouldn't point that as the number one reason, or even a really high reason for the Fed to be behind the curve. I don't think they need to be, and it's not something that's stated in there. Again, they have reports. They have your viewers or listeners can go look at them. They're right there in plain daylight. In there, they don't have fiscal policy.
Stick with fiscal policy for a sec, just because this is the other issue I know you're very interested in. John, for listeners who don't know him, is a macroeconomist. He cares about both monetary and fiscal policy, and his work in monetary theory is a little more celebrated in the sense that he doesn't have a rule in fiscal policy named after him. But okay. But when we think about fiscal policy, you have been, for a long, long time, very worried about the size of the deficits and the resulting debt level relative to GDP. A lot of people on the other side of the political fence have said this is nothing to worry about. The United States can live beyond its means. It's not like an individual. We're only borrowing it from ourselves. There's really no harm. And if you look at the world, you could say, well, they look right so far. Do you think they're going to be for me, my view on it is that deficits for a large country like the United States that has quite a bit of monetary authority, and that people like to hold dollars as a store of value and will not flee from them without a really attractive alternative with a stable economic and political system. Yet someday there might come a day where people don't want to buy American bonds, and those that deficit, which looks benign, becomes disastrous. Is that your forecast? Not forecast, is that your concern?
Yeah, it's a concern. Again, we have history where a better fiscal policy has been where you don't have the deficits. So on average, you have a balanced budget. It means you have deficits in recessions. You have near surpluses in good times. It's a good system. You can think of it as a rule, as a strategy for doing that. It makes sense. It's worked pretty well. And when you get off that, you have the debt rising as a share of GDP. That means interest costs will go up eventually for the government. And I think it's a better policy. I don't have the same calculations as the so-called Taylor rule, but they do suggest that a better policy would be have a near balanced budget on average. So you have surpluses and deficits, but we're not there yet. And I'm not sure we will be there. So we'll sacrifice a somewhat higher debt to GDP ratio. Debt to GDP will go up because the debt's rising faster than GDP. And that's a concern. But the main concern now, I'd say, I mean, that would be very important, but I'm more concerned about the Fed and getting the Fed in line. Sorry to keep going back to that.
Oh, that's all right. I'm restraining myself from making a PG-13 joke about Robert Solow and Milton Friedman, but listeners with some background can send me an email if you want. Let's talk a little bit about the COVID, the recession that was caused or was the result of lockdowns. It's a very different kind of recession. It wasn't a decentralized situation where millions of actors as consumers, employers, employees were responding to economic changes that set a bunch of other things into motion as a result. This was a plague that the government and the citizens decided was a good time to stay home. And then when it got relatively safer, as we got vaccines and more benign types, variants of the coronavirus, people said, well, okay, I think it's time to go back to work. Some of them didn't. They decided they literally didn't go back to work. They worked from home. Massive set of changes that has rippled through the economy. And again, many of them manifest themselves in the form of something that's rare in our lifetime, empty shelves, as you mentioned, alluded to earlier, cargo ships queuing and bizarrely large numbers at American ports. It's amazing to me that this has not, in and of itself, caused an immense amount of economic disruption. Why? Why has the economy been so resilient? Now, I think Keynesians, of which you are not a standard kind, and I am definitely not one either, Keynesians say, well, it's easy. The government spent all this money, all that fiscal policy that you mentioned earlier. They borrowed a lot of money. They gave it to citizens. They gave it to businesses to keep employees on payroll. And that Keynesian stimulus kept the economy from sinking. Do you share that story?
I don't. It's because I've studied it. I've looked at it. You don't have to just wave your hand. You can look at the data.
I can't just tell stories.
You can.
Feel good about myself. Come on. That's the essence of economics.
You make the rest of us. Keep it up. You make the rest of us feel good. But you also can have data that supports this view. And that's what I've tried to stress. And I think the other thing is the resilience of the economy is quite terrific. I mean, a lot of my courses have been online. I had last fall in person with masks, but online is terrific. And you know this from your own work, Russ. You probably know at the university. There's an amazing ability for people to supplement. And I think the Zoom is a big part of it. Mr. Zoom is just a few miles from here, Eric Wan, and it's a tremendous benefit. So I think what's happening, yes, people are working at home. You're living in Manhattan and working at home rather than going to the office, but you're actually doing a lot of work. Now, obviously, it's not going to be completely online in the future, but I think there will be a hybrid. And to some extent, I think we've seen the economy bounce back because people are finding other ways to do their work, other ways to commute. Now, we're not over this, to be sure. I mean, there's a lot of Stanford students who are being diagnosed with the disease. And so we're trying to take that into account. But I think what you're seeing is an amazing ability for the economy to interact. I would also say there's these high-tech firms. There's Google, there's Facebook, there's Apple. And they happen to be nearby as well, but it doesn't matter. But they're global. They're just a tremendous benefit. So I worry, maybe another episode, maybe you've already done this, Russ, is, what's the story with these firms? Should we be encouraging them to do more? Are they stifling free speech? But I think that there's enormous benefit from that, and you can use that. It's not macro so much, except that it's emphasis on markets and on freedom and on the ability to use the price system effectively. And I think it's a very promising thing. It's not monetary and fiscal policy generally. It's regulatory policy. It's continuing to allow these firms to operate and to do what's good. Now, to be sure, there's controversy. There's bipartisan complaints about many of the firms. But I think the more that there can be a serious discussion of what they're doing and the benefits, and I think that's one of the reasons why some countries have done well coming out of this. Others still have a long way to go. That's the sad part of this. We're not done. A lot of parts of Africa are still struggling, and we may struggle more ourselves.
I just want to come back to your point about the data. You know, when I made my, I would not call it a back of the envelope calculation, but after this, therefore, because of this, which is a classic fallacy, post hoc, ergo propter hoc, after this, therefore, because of this. Obviously, you can't just look at something that happened concurrently or shortly thereafter or a long time after and say, well, it must have been caused by that. But I do think that the people who have defended the stimulus packages would argue that they have data too. So we can close on this. One, I'm curious what you think is distinctive about – how would you summarize why your case that was ineffective is correct? Is it a timing issue? Is it a magnitude issue? And then secondly, is there stuff you've written that we can link to that viewers who are not technically proficient, who are just casual consumers of economics, not grad students and professional economists, that they could read and enjoy?
Absolutely. It's actually a lot of it is just looking at some charts, and you can see these big infusions of money, which didn't affect consumption at all. It's pretty, there's three. There's a two with Trump and one with Biden. And these were they're pretty much one-time payments. They tried to limit it to people who are not so wealthy. But if you just look at the data, it's really the consumption didn't go up. It stayed
so
pretty steady.
So people saved it.
Yeah. Yeah. And as far as we can tell, I mean, obviously it didn't save every penny, and not everybody, some people use it, but in general, this was not, these three so-called stimulus packages, as far as I can tell, looking in detail at the data, were not stimulative. Now, it doesn't mean other things the government were doing. Maybe this bipartisan infrastructure program had a difference. That's relatively new to investigate, but the others did not. I don't think there's any dispute about it.
Are you optimistic about the future of the U.S. economy? I am anxious on political grounds for the future of the United States. And I think that has implications for economic policy. It's not, they don't work totally independently. What do you think?
Well, I'm more optimistic than I probably should be, but I think that we're in a situation where we're having a good discussion. We're having debates. Maybe it's more pulled apart than normal. You know, I hope you're dealing with this incredible partisanship that we see. But I can't be too pessimistic, because unless the disease comes back or something like that, I think we're following the right approach. And I think if you compare it with other countries, it's looking better. The danger is a lot of risk, that's for sure. For sure, we could regulate, we could get confused, we could have a terrible monetary policy. All those things are risks. But I think the data and the analysis is suggesting we need to improve policy, monetary policy. We need to improve fiscal policy. You've seen the debates about that too. A regulatory policy is harder, but I think I could give my examples of the high-tech firms, and let's not try to prevent them from doing the good things. And so I'm optimistic that it is a terrible tragedy that the world has faced, but I think we're going to come out of it fine.
My guest today has been John Taylor. John, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Thank you, Russ. Thank you very much.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.